bush and grass of the world and forcing us to breathe an air that is threaded and laced with all the toxins that produces.
And David, I want to go to the point that you made about pollution, intense air pollution elsewhere in developing countries in particular. Now, of course, you mentioned Delhi. 37 of the 40 most polluted cities in the world are in South Asia. So if you could talk first about the causes of this pollution in South Asia, it's not forest fires there. And also the fact that just 10 years ago, we saw images repeatedly from China, from Chinese cities, Beijing, Shanghai, etc., that were the most polluted at the time. What were the steps that China took to reduce that pollution, and are those replicable in these cities across South Asia?
Well, to start with a really big headline figure, it's estimated that about 10 million people are dying prematurely every year around the globe because of the effects of air pollution. And that is an almost unfathomably large number. It's death at the scale of the Holocaust every single year. And while it's morally different in many profound ways, I think we are really unfortunately distracted from the scale of the suffering that that air pollution produces. The causes are different in different parts of the world, and the impacts are different, such that in a place like the U.S., which has relatively clean air by global standards, still we're seeing something like 350,000 Americans dying every year, in part as a result of air pollution. And that's death equivalent to the amount of Americans who passed away from COVID in the first year of the pandemic. But the impacts are much darker and more striking elsewhere in the world, as you mentioned, most dramatically across South Asia and indeed in India. And the causes there are multiple, but the most significant one is the two most significant ones are the burning of fossil fuels, particularly coal. For every 1,000 people that get electricity from the burning of coal every year, one dies. And agricultural burning, which we've stopped doing much of in places like the U.S. and Europe, but which is still a relatively common practice in other parts of the world. It's one of the reasons, one of the ways that the Amazon has been deforested in Brazil as well. Across India, on average, lifespans have been reduced by this air pollution by 6 years, which means that this is a country of more than a billion people. And on average, every single one of them will have six less lives of life thanks to the effect of air pollution. And in parts of India, as I mentioned earlier, including Delhi, the number gets up to 9 and even 10 years of life lost. In that city, you have something like half of all children suffering some amount of lung impairment thanks to the pollution. As you mentioned, there are encouraging signs at the global level here. You know, 10 million is a huge, huge number. Presumably, it's actually smaller than it's been in the past. Our estimates are growing, but they're probably just because our measures have been getting better. We are probably at or past the peak of global air pollution because we are retiring so much coal capacity. We are slowly but surely moving away from fossil fuel in certain sectors, transportation and electricity. And so as a result, around the world, probably fewer people are dying of air pollution than did a few decades ago. But where they are dying, the story, you know, in certain parts of the world, the story is very different. And in South Asia, things have been getting dramatically worse over the last couple of decades. It is an encouraging story to see what happened in China, but on some level, it's not that encouraging. The Chinese government saw the public health impacts of what they called in the middle of the last decade, the airpocalypse, and saw that it was having real political consequences, that people were really frustrated that the government was not able to protect the health and lives of its citizens. And as a result, they did basically two things. They started in an ambitious way to ramp up their green energy investment, which is still, I mean, they're doing much more spending on building out wind and solar than the rest of the world almost combined. But they also moved their dirty fossil fuel plants, their coal plants, away from the cities. And that is useful. It means that the people, you know, there are fewer people living right next to the coal plants. But ultimately, it's a sort of a half measure, which has a significant impact on public health, but doesn't really help us all that much in the fight against the climate crisis that we're trying to, you know, do at the same time. India is moving to some degree in that direction. They've suggested over the last month or two, in fact, that they're much more committed to expansion of green energy and much less committed to a coal-powered future than seemed possible just a year or two ago. But nevertheless, when you have global mortality figures like 10 million a year, you know, those deaths add up very quickly. And we should, I think, be focusing on them much more than we are at a global policy level. And indeed, whenever we think about the world in moral terms, which we should do more and more.
And speaking about thinking about the world in moral terms, let's talk about the world here at home. The racial disparities when it comes to the effects of air pollution, David Wallace Wells.
Well, you know, in certain ways, air pollution is a complicated story to tell on those lines because you don't always know where the smoke is going to be. And in fact, in places where there has been a lot of smoke from wildfire in particular, it's often the wealthiest communities in the world who are suffering. You see, you know, fires in Malibu, for instance, cleaning out, you know, multimillion-dollar homes fairly regularly. And around the Bay Area, there's been research done showing that, you know, the richer neighborhoods with newer homes aren't actually better protected, with the infrastructure of the house against the penetration of smoke than some poorer neighborhoods, which is a bit counterintuitive. And it has to do in part with the fact that we haven't really reckoned with the sort of ventilation crisis posed by both this and the pandemic. And many new homes have things like, you know, even fancy homes have things like, gas exhaust vents that can let smoke into the home. But when it comes to more traditional fossil fuel pollution produced by, you know, power plants and highways, of course, it is the marginalized communities who suffer most. That is where those things have been located by people who care less about the lives of people living next to them. And the effects there are really quite startling. One study I think about a lot measured just the impact of installing EasyPass toll plazas on a highway. And for those who don't know, this is a, you know, an automatic mechanism that allows you to drive through rather than stopping and paying somebody at the toll booth, which meant that cars don't have to idle and slow down in that particular area of road. They can just pass through, and the result is considerably less pollution. And the simple fact of building out those toll plazas reduced the local impact of on premature birth and low birth weight by something like 10 or 15%. There are other impacts that have shown that other studies showing that putting a single air purifier in the classroom can help cognitive performance and test achievement, which is not necessarily the best measure of student success, but in any event, one that we have, it can benefit those students as much as cutting the class size in half, which is the kind of thing that, you know, should be heralded all around the country and indeed all around the world, given how much so many people are focused on the academic success of our children. We see effects on cancers of all kinds, on respiratory disease, on coronary disease, on, you know, every measure of public health and well-being that you can imagine. And of course, because we live in a world in which the sorts of people who are forced to live next to coal-fired power plants or next to 12-lane highways are the people who have the least advantages in our society. Those are the people who are suffering most dramatically.
And, David,
and at the global level, that seems to be true as well.
Canada is the biggest supplier of oil to the United States. Now it's wildfires are the biggest supplier of smoke to the United States. If you can talk about that connection, also, let's not forget that with this debt ceiling bill that was considered a success that saved the country's economy, what was tagged onto it was Joe Manchin's insistence on that Mountain Valley pipeline, greenhouse gas emissions expected from the frack gas inside, equivalent to something like 26 to 37 coal-powered power plants. Coal, of course, he's gotten millions from and the largest recipient of fossil fuel money in Congress. But if you could start off by talking more specifically about these, why these more than 400 blazes are burning across Canada's 10 provinces and territories. They're forcing tens of thousands to evacuate, something we probably wouldn't even know in the United States if it weren't for the smoke that's blanketing our country.
Yeah, I think, the answer here, the explanation here is quite clear. The climate is warming because we are burning fossil fuels. The lion's share of historical responsibility there lies with the richest countries of the world. In fact, Canada, the U.S. as a country, is responsible for most of the damage done to the world's environment, much larger than the share contributed by China. And since carbon hangs in the air for centuries, China will never catch up to the impact that the U.S. has had. On a per capita historical basis, Canada is actually a worse contributor than the U.S. because they're a more fossil fuel dependent country even than the U.S. is. the total impact is smaller because they have many fewer people. But on a per capita basis, they're a much worse contributor. And I think one of the perverse lessons of the these wildfires is that we've gotten so used to sort of locating the grim impacts of climate change in the global south, where the people who have done least to create the problem suffer those impacts, that when they come to us, to our front step, to our doorstep, we're horrified. But of course, we've been effectively dumping that pollution on the global south now for many decades. And I think just talking for a minute about the carbon inequalities involved here is really, really startling and striking. The average resident of Mali in Africa uses only as much carbon every year as the average British tea kettle. The average American refrigerator has a larger carbon footprint than the average resident of Nigeria, which is not even a poor African country by African standards. It's a middle-income African country. And historically, the entire continent of Africa has contributed something like, at most, 3%, according to some tabulations, as little as 1% of the disruption to the climate that has been caused primarily by the U.S. and Europe over the last couple of centuries. And that is a lasting monument. I don't think that many people appreciate just how dramatic a contribution and a disruption, a degradation, that project has really been. We have now added more carbon to the atmosphere by weight than the sum total of everything that has ever been built on this planet by humans. There is more carbon in the atmosphere today than the sum total of all living matter on life today, on Earth today. So we have done more damage to the world's atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels than everything we have ever done on this planet. And it will last for centuries at least, and probably millennia, which means that we are going to be reaping the consequences of this damage for many, many generations to come. The choices we are making today will determine whether we navigate that future at a relatively lower level of warming or a relatively higher one. But it's quite perverse and disheartening to see leaders in countries like the U.S. and Canada and Europe as well lecture the nations of the developing world, try to stop financing even for their or not aid financing for their renewable energy development, while we at home continue to approve fossil fuel programs, which, while relatively small in the global scheme of things, just add to our gargantuan and sort of unforgivable climate debt. There was a study published a few days ago in one of the Nature journals tabulating the ultimate responsibility of the countries of the global north towards the global south for climate damages already incurred, and the total ran into the tens of trillions of dollars. I ran a calculation myself in a piece I wrote a couple of years ago about climate reparations and climate justice, in which I calculated that using the math that the cost of reparation should be what it would actually take to take the carbon out of the atmosphere, that the U.S. alone might owe as big a moral debt as $50 trillion. And the global north as a whole owed a debt of something like $250 trillion. So we are doing incredible damage to the poor countries of the world through all of our reckless development and spending on fossil fuels. And, you know, we basically live protected from it by our wealth. But when we are reminded of just how damaged the planet has become, as we have been today and yesterday and the day before in New York, we are horrified. And I think, you know, as Bill McKibben said at the top of the segment, or as you quoted him saying at the top of the segment, it's a really useful reminder when we are suffering in this way to remember that many people elsewhere in the world without nearly the advantages that we have deal with something like this, something like these impacts almost every day of their lives, and in fact have their lives shaped quite profoundly by the climate in ways that someone like me, who lives on the 15th floor of a concrete high-rise in lower Manhattan, doesn't appreciate, even as I write about it every day. It's almost hard for me to wrap my head around that. And the wildfire smoke and the eerie apocalyptic glow swaddling New York over the last couple of days, making everyone I know cough, is a reminder of just how much more people elsewhere in the world are suffering as the result of our irresponsible behavior.
David Wallace Wells, we want to thank you so much for being with us, New York Times opinion writer. We'll link to your latest column, "As Smoke Darkens the Sky, the Future Becomes Clear." David Wallace Wells is also the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Next up, we look at why the world's deadliest wars go unreported with the award-winning journalist and author Anjan Sundaram. Stay with us.
¶¶
The Envoys by Abdulaziz. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to look at why some of the world's deadliest wars go unreported. That's the headline of a recent piece by the acclaimed Indian war correspondent Anjan Sundaram. He writes, quote, "Despite the world's technological advances, conflicts like the one in the Central African Republic are still shrouded in darkness, and we often don't know the perpetrators, who is attacked, or why. The neglect of such war zones is the consequence of an international news system still structured by colonial relationships. Foreign correspondents fly out from global capitals such as Washington, D.C. and London, more or less to similar places at similar times to tell us more or less the same stories." That's Anjan Sundaram, reporting in Foreign Policy, joining us now from Mexico City. He recently published his third memoir about life as a war correspondent, titled Breakup, A Marriage in Wartime. His recent opinion piece, published on the front page of the New York Times, about the Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who he calls the West's most beloved dictator, is headlined Reducing Rwanda to Tyranny. Anjan, thanks so much for joining us today. If you can lay out that piece that you just wrote, why the world's deadliest wars go unreported? Why?
Thank you, Amy and Nermeen, for having me. Indeed, I can illustrate, you know, that lack of reporting through a story in the Central African Republic. I was traveling in the west of the country with a Polish abbot, a priest. And we drove through a rebel zone where the government had destroyed radio antennae, so we couldn't get news from the region. And as we drove in the abbot's white pickup, we stopped at village after village, and in each village deserted because they had, you know, abandoned their homes, thinking that maybe we were the government come to ambush them or attack them. The abbot honked, and someone would run out of the forest or run out of some hiding spot and thrust a piece of paper through our window. And on that piece of paper that fell into my lap, I would find a list of names of people who had been attacked, who were hungry, who were sick, who needed medicine. And we would take these pages back to the capital, to the main city of the region, as a form of war correspondence. And, you know, it's striking that in this age of, you know, as you mentioned in my piece, technological advancement of, you know, of us being inundated with information, that this is how news from war zones is still collected by hand, by the brave action of, you know, one priest, one person. And I think that's very striking, because it tells us that though we imagine that we cover the world well, the international news covers the world well, there are these enormous blind spots in places like the Central African Republic or the Democratic Republic of Congo, where nearly 6 million people have died been killed in the war since 1996. And these enormous wars, some of the greatest, you know, in the biggest in our world today, and some of the greatest since World War II, are still relatively, you know, still pass relatively unreported in the international news.
Let's talk about the Central African Republic, because that's the subject of your book, Breakup, which is just out, came out a couple of months ago. You said you spoke to many people in the Central African Republic while you were reporting, and you said that the first thing people asked you was not for food or medicine, but if people knew outside what was happening in the Central African Republic. So if you could talk about that, what people said to you and why it's so important that their stories get out.
Absolutely. And I think another striking quote was from my reporting partner, Thierry Messongo, a Central African journalist. We were sitting down once and we were looking up at the moon, and he said to me, "I think people know more about the moon than they know about this, what's happening in my country." And I think, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. The war in the Central African Republic was initiated in 2013 by a group of, you know, mostly Muslim rebels from the Northwest. And people have forgotten the history of the Central African Republic. But before it was a French colony through the 1900s, there were powerful Muslim sultanates who ruled over that territory, and the French defeated them. The French defeated a very powerful sultanate called the Dar al-Kuti, which means the door to the forest, and a sultan named Rabi al-Zubair. And when after the French took over, people forgot about those Muslim kingdoms, but the Muslim populations of that region have not forgotten. And in 2013, they made a bid for power and to reclaim the glory that they had lost to the French. And though, you know, they took over the country briefly, they were defeated again. And unfortunately, that defeat led to the ethnic cleansing of Muslims in the Central African Republic. The Muslim population of the country was reduced from roughly 15% of the country to about 9% by some accounts. So an enormous, you know, hundreds of thousands of people of Muslims cleansed from the country. And the number of dead in that war has still not been properly counted. But what it tells us, what the Central African Republic tells us, is that many, many countries are looking back to their pasts before the West ruled over them, and looking back to looking to reclaim their identities and past glory. And though the you know, this rebel group, they took power only briefly, they did succeed in pushing out the French, and this created a void in the Central African Republic that has been filled by Russia. So, as I mentioned early on in the segment, Russia's notorious Wagner Group is now active in the Central African Republic. A U.S. diplomatic cable leaked earlier this year pointed out that, you know, the Wagner Group is mining millions, hundreds of millions, possibly, of dollars worth of diamonds and gold that it is using to recruit and buy equipment to finance its war in Ukraine. And so, you know, it tells us that countries like the Central African Republic are so desperate to turn away from the West and turn away from Western colonial crimes, for which the West has, you know, rarely apologized, that it is willing to ally with Russia, China, and even at the cost of furthering the war in Ukraine.
John, can you talk about the fact, you know, what you think needs to happen, how it is that these wars can receive the coverage that they more than warrant? You've called for a multipolar news world. How is it that countries in the global south itself, newsrooms, can report on conflicts in the global south without going through London or New York?
Sure. So I did my PhD research on this topic on post-colonial news. And one of the things that I elaborated was the colonial structure of international news. We still have correspondents flying out from global capitals, Western capitals, mostly like New York and London, to report on the peripheries of the world and bring us back information, you know, and then winning the prizes and the recognition in the West, often using work and reporting that local reporters have worked for years on in the peripheries. And so there's still much colonialism in the international news structure. But I think, you know, instead of continually blaming the West and criticizing the West for not caring enough about places like the Central African Republic and the Congo, which to some degree is understandable, these places are so far away from the West, why put all the burden on Western media? I want to ask why wealthier, you know, global South nations such as Nigeria and Kenya and India don't do more to report on places like the Central African Republic and the Congo and even conflicts nearby them. If you open the newspapers, you know, the international pages of newspapers in many of these global South countries, you'll find most of the international news is sourced from the BBC and Reuters. And why is that? You know, Nigeria and India are now middle-income countries. Their wealth is rising very quickly. They have vibrant media sectors. Why don't they care more? And you know, I'm from India, so why don't we care more about our neighboring countries? Why do we rely on The Guardian or the BBC to bring us news about countries that are a couple of hundred kilometers away from our border? And that's the question I really want to ask. I want to put the onus back on the global south and ask, you know, as we rise to levels of greater economic prosperity, there comes a responsibility also to report on the world, to cast and share our perspective, the global south's perspective, on many of these wars, and to stop, you know, criticizing Western media and Western nations for not caring enough.
Anjan Sundaram, can you talk about your decision to go to the Democratic Republic of Congo and also in explaining what's happening there, how that links to the piece that you wrote about the brutal dictator, Paul Kagame, your headline, "He's a brutal dictator, one of the West's best friends."
Absolutely. Yes. So when I showed up in the Congo, this was about 15 years ago, I was studying mathematics at Yale University. I had a job at Goldman Sachs to work as a mathematician there. And I opened the newspaper one day at lunchtime, and I turned to the middle of the newspaper, bottom of the page. There was a little story about how 4 million people back then had been killed in the Congo War. And it struck me how that little story wasn't on the front page. 4 million people, that's a huge number. And from there, I began to, you know, research and understand more about the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And when I was paying my final bill at Yale, the cashier happened to be from Congo. And I ended up staying with her in-laws in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And from there, from this inside perspective, living with a local family instead of living in a hotel, I began to report on the country. I bought a one-way ticket to Kinshasa, lived with that family, and began to report on the country. And it was, for me, a remarkable education in journalism, because every day the stories that I published for the Associated Press, for whom I became a stringer, and this whole experience I recount in my first book, my first memoir, Stringer, A Reporter's Journey in the Congo. Every day the news that I published, you know, was then criticized by my neighbors on the street. I would go and drink beer with them or buy, you know, cell phone credit in the evenings. And they would, you know, scold me and tell me how my reporting was helping or hurting their country and holding me accountable at a street level, which is a rare experience as an international reporter. Usually we find ourselves living in, you know, nice hotels, dining with local politicians and, you know, the elite of the country. And here I was being held accountable by, you know, very ordinary, very middle class, lower middle class people who are living almost in, you know, conditions akin to a slum. And that was a particular, you know, experience of reporting and education. That's how I learned about, you know, international reporting. From the Congo, I then moved to Rwanda, the subject of my recent New York Times article. I went to Rwanda to teach a class of about a dozen Rwandan reporters, and they were taken out by the government and by the president, Paul Kagame, one by one. So a colleague was shot dead on the same day he criticized the president. I showed up at his funeral, and his wife was holding their little infant child. And very few journalists dared even to come to that funeral because they were scared of being associated with him. And, you know,
Anjan, I hate to say this, but we have 30 seconds, so I want to give you a chance to wrap up. But we're going to continue this conversation after the show and post it at democracynow.org. Your final comments on this.
Sure. So, you know, my report and my book, Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship, that's my second book, is about how President Paul Kagame shut down the press in Rwanda. You know, not only my class, but the press in the country. And it describes the journey a country goes through as it's being silenced and as dictatorship and authoritarianism takes hold, a process that we're seeing in many countries around the world, not just in Rwanda today.
Anjan Sundaram, award-winning journalist and author, the latest book, Break Up a Marriage in Wartime. We're going to do part two at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nirmin Shah.
Are you interested in radio, community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.